Welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and creative entrepreneur, bringing you interviews, inspiration, and information on writing, publishing options, and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free author blueprint, and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 323 of the podcast. And it's Saturday, 27th of May, 2017, as I record this. So today I have an interview with screenwriter Asm Gaines, and we're talking about those LA writers' rooms, collaboration, how self-publishing his own one-act play got him a deal, as well as how you could pitch your book. And this is such a great interview, and I could have talked to Asm forever. So if you're interested in getting your book to the screen, let's face it, most of us are, then hopefully you'll enjoy this interview today. So in publishing this week, nothing exciting other than more comments on what I already talked about last week. So we'll go straight into my personal update. Last weekend, I was at Crimefest in Bristol in England, and it was great. And it's interesting because so many of these literary festivals a few years ago were just not happy to, you know, involve indie authors. But over the years, by making relationships and things, I'm welcome there, and I speak there, and I'm on panels, and being self-published is not even mentioned. For me, I was on a panel on the Saturday, sort of prime time, and how I publish my books was not even mentioned. So that to me is what the future of what I see, you know, should happen. I don't think it should matter how the books are out there in the world. And my book sat very happily alongside other published authors, professionally, traditionally published authors, let's say, because I'm professionally published, in the bookstore. And this was exciting too, because although I've spoken at Crimefest over the last few years, my books haven't been in the bookstore because that's been run by a bookseller, and my books have only been on CreateSpace. But this year is different because I'm with Ingram Spark as well as CreateSpace. And so the festival was able to order my books, and I didn't even ask them to. I wasn't expecting my books there, but someone told me that they were in the store. And so I went, and indeed they had ordered four of my books that were sitting there alongside other people's and looked awesome. So that is a recommendation. If you are speaking at literary festivals, then make sure your books are available through Ingram Spark, because then the bookseller can get a discount. So that's cool. I also taught a session on self-publishing and talked to a lot of UK authors, including some bigger names who will be going hybrid this year. So, for example, authors who have UK deals are going to self-publish in the US, or vice versa. And so that's really interesting because that's definitely changed. And, you know, I was joking with somebody, you know, we should have a sort of, you know, superstars of hybrid panel, because, you know, that really is the way that a lot of authors are going now. You know, they're having a look at their contracts, seeing what they have licensed, and then doing the rights in those other countries themselves. So definitely well worth doing. I am also still working like a crazy person on how to market a book, the third edition. And I am now onto hand edits, but it's pretty hardcore because the book is over 70,000 words, which is really long. Again, don't do what I do, do what I say. You know, again, would I have been better to write three or four smaller books on marketing? Yes, probably. That would be a good idea, similar to the way Chris Fox is doing things, for example, or Steve Scott. But I don't know, I kind of like also having a magnum opus impact, and the book really is, I'm really happy with it. And also it's been great to revisit my own basics. For example, I redid my bio. I mean, I pay a lot more attention to JF Penn in terms of things like tweaking categories and things like that. But Joanna Penn, I literally hadn't looked at my nonfiction categories for some of my Joanna Penn books for years, like since I published them. So when I was
going, you know, as I'm going through the book and editing, I'm like, yeah, I need to do that. And so I've revisited my nonfiction categories. And what's amazing is you think that there are a certain number of categories, and then you go look and you find they've, I mean, even while I've been writing this book, they've added more categories under nonfiction and fiction. So you can always use Amazon Author Central to email KDP help and get your book moved into or added into more granular categories. So that's a bit of a tip. If you haven't looked at the categories for, let's say, 6 months, it's well worth doing that. So yeah, I've been doing that. Also, yeah, the hand edits are going well. The book's on pre-order for the 6th of July, but I'm aiming to try and get the audiobook done and also the print book to be out at the same time. So you can pre-order How to Market a Book, the third edition, on all ebook stores right now, and the print pre-order will be up as soon as I can finish it. And if you read at Kobo, very excitingly, you can get 30% off the pre-order by using the promo code MARKET30, so MARKET30, as a discount code or a promotion code when you check out, and you'll get 30% off the pre-order. That's Kobo only, thanks to our sponsors of the show. So that's cool. But it's also interesting, and you know, I'm kind of telling you these things is the things I'm learning again as I write books. It's crazy. I'm actually writing for the audio narration version. So the earlier versions of How to Market a Book had a lot more bullet points. So I'm finding that I'm using fewer bullet points and more joining words to make it a smoother read for my narrator. And also I had a lot of hyperlinks in the earlier editions, and now I will either be using a sort of a custom URL, you know, thecreativepen.com/quiet or silence, I think. thecreativepen.com/silence, I think, is my headphones, my noise cancelling headphones that I use to write, you know, stuff like that. So where it's a redirect link rather than using a hyperlink. Now that's really useful for one, the audiobook, but two, also the print book, because you have to fix all the hyperlinks between the ebook version and the print anyway. So for nonfiction, it's really common to use links to external material. But I'm really finding that I'm assessing, do I really need this? Because it's annoying when you're listening to an audiobook to have someone read out loads of URLs. So yeah, it's very interesting to consider writing more for a narration. My nonfiction books sell really well in audio. So yeah, really interesting process. Also this week, technical fun. Technical, so much fun that I didn't want to do it myself. We've implemented HTTPS on JF Pen and the Creative Pen. Now, why? And you may or may not have seen this. It's basically when a site, if you're in a browser, on the top left-hand corner, it'll say secure, or the URL will be HTTPS. Now, why do this? Well, you know, the Creative Pen is a pretty big site, and Google wants websites to be secure. They've had a HTTPS everywhere campaign. They've announced it as a ranking signal, and they've started indexing secure pages over unsecured pages. So that is a big deal for me. My business is not dependent on, but you know, organic search is a huge traffic mechanism for the Creative Pen. So it's very important for my business to have a website that ranks well. But obviously the thought of doing something like implementing HTTPS just sounds awful as to someone who is, you know, and I am technical to a point, as in, you know, I do a lot of my own stuff. But you don't need to be a coder to run a website for most of it, but it's great to have some help. So I have been, I've had the lovely Nate Hofelder helping me with my sites. And you might know Nate from the Digital Reader, which reports on indie and publishing news, but Nate also offers technical help for authors, which is great because it's quite specific around our industry. And Nate has done my HTTPS. You know, we've had a few bits and bobs of issues as expected with any kind of technical change. And he's been able to deal with those. And it's really helped me because I hate all that stuff. I really do. It makes me quite depressed. And that's why I've put it off for ages. Like, I've had it on my to-do list for probably 6 months. And in the end, I was like, I'm just going to have someone else do it. And Nate is fantastic. So go to The Digital Reader and check out Nate's pages on his technical help if you need technical help for your site. And of course, you could tell him I said hi and sent you over there. That would be cool. In useful stuff, and this is country-specific or at least perhaps continent-specific. So if you want to build a successful online business and you're in the UK or Europe, or if you're in America and you want to come join us, in November, there is the Upreneur Summit. Now, I'm pretty excited about this. I am speaking, but also there are some, I would be going anyway because there are some amazing speakers coming. So Chris Ducker is running the event. He runs Upreneur, and Chris was on the show a couple of years ago now to talk about outsourcing. Pat Flynn from Smart Passive Income is speaking. John Lee Dumas from Entrepreneur on Fire. Also, John was on the show earlier this year. All those guys make six figures a month online, which I think is pretty incredible. And they all run scalable businesses. Plus other speakers whose income I don't know much about, but amazing speakers. John Jantz from the Duct Tape Marketing. You might have read his books if you're into marketing. Carrie Green from Female Entrepreneurs Association. Amy Schmittauer from Savvy Sexy Social. And Janet Murray from Soulful PR, who's been on the show. And a whole load more of amazing speakers. But it's not just for the speakers, it's also for the networking. And I'm really looking forward to meeting people who are very serious about online business. And so if you are a nonfiction writer and or speaker and you want to expand into internet stuff, or if you are a business-minded fiction author who wants to get some ideas about what other income streams you can make with your book, then join me and all these amazing speakers at upreneursummit.com. I'll put the link in the show notes, but it's Upreneur, like entrepreneur, but Y-O-U at the beginning, upreneursummit.com. Very cool. I'm really excited about that. It's, you know, when Chris asked me to speak, I was like, yay, that's fantastic. And I'm at this point now where I'm trying to cut down my speaking, but this is such a great opportunity and I would be going to this event anyway. That would be cool. Okay, so thanks for all your emails and tweets and comments this week. The winner, I think, of the interesting thing you're doing while listening to the show this week is H.A. Titus, who says, crafting a pattern for a cosplay cyborg arm while listening to the latest podcast. Loved learning about bookbinding. That's very cool. And H.A. Titus, I'd love you to send a picture of the cosplay cyborg arm when you finish it, because that's really cool. Thanks to Timothy Trimble for sending me a book selfie with a successful author mindset. Always lovely to see my books in the wild. And thanks also for the lovely review and recommendation on your blog, Timothy. That means a lot. Edwin Downward says, got my fix listening to the show Wednesday, driving to the ferry terminal to meet my wife, rewarded by sighting two herons, two eagles and a seal, which is lovely. A.L. Michael says, been listening to the Creative Pen and Self-Publishing Formula podcast every drive to and from work. Now have four new synopses written and a three-year plan made. Wow, that's so organized. I don't have a three-year plan, so go for it. Okay, Christine Bernard says, decided to start listening to the show while running. Best idea ever, barely felt like I was running. And also said, suddenly seriously considering self-publishing because of the podcast with Dean Crawford. Really interesting that, you know, I've had quite a lot of emails about this, about how people feel a certain way about self-publishing until they hear a positive experience about it and understand the shift between the kind of negative view of self-publishing as vanity and then the positive view of self-publishing as taking control of your author career and becoming an author entrepreneur. And it's pretty funny because I'm actually debating at a London event called Bite the Book in June, and it will be on the author as publisher vanity question mark or something else. And I will be debating against a traditional industry figure, a well-known agent in the London scene. And I was like, do I really want to do this? And I was like, yeah, to be fair, I think it will be interesting because I can absolutely talk to the publishing industry about this being a positive choice for authors. And also I can just, you know, throw back at them that most of them have their own self-publishing arms these days. And many agents are actually helping authors self-publish. So the industry is not sort of butting heads anymore. It's very much a rainbow of options. Let's say that. Oh, so much fun. Right, today's show is sponsored by my own How to Write a Novel course, which I created while writing End of Days. So you get a behind the scenes look at how the book came together. Now, and just an aside before I carry on reading, I also got a tweet this week that said, sometimes I forget that the Creative Pen writes novels. And I'm like, please don't forget this, because as I posted on my blog last week, most of my book sales income is from fiction, and it's an increasing percentage because I write more fiction than I do nonfiction. I know you guys often don't care about my fiction, but I do write it. So I'll carry on with my ad read. Is it your dream to write a novel, but you just don't know where to start? Have you started writing only to run out of ideas? Are you suffering from self-doubt about whether you're good enough to write a novel? Do you feel overwhelmed by all the information and craft books out there? If you've answered yes to any of these questions, then this course is for you. And the course has videos, audios, and slides, and takes you through the entire process from idea to finished draft. And one course member, Lee Anderson, said, "This course is exactly what I was looking for. I now feel well on my way to writing and completing my first draft. It has been a real breakthrough for me." And you can find out more at thecreativepen.com/write-novel. And I'm actually pretty proud of that course because, I am at some point going to write a book on how to write a novel, take my course and turn it into a book rather than the other way around. But it's definitely, yeah, I'm really happy with that. It really helped me with my own novel writing process. And in fact, I said this to someone else this week, if you want to learn something, like if you want to embed the knowledge of something, write a book on it, because by using your time to organize your thoughts and try and help other people with that information, you actually help yourself. So there you go. So this type of sponsorship or ad read pays for the hosting and transcription, but my time in producing the show is primarily sponsored by you guys. So a big thank you to all the people supporting on Patreon, all the generous listeners who've been supporting me for over 18 months now, and you get all those extra Q&As. You just can't get enough of my voice. Thanks to new patrons this week: Kevin Fiedler, April Kung, Janet K. McNamara, Anita Renahan, PJ Books Bookstore, Andrea Mai, Sarah General, Julie Pickerel, and H. Lovelin Betterson. So thank you so much to all the new patrons and to everyone supporting the show on Patreon. I appreciate it so, so, so much. Like the tweets and emails, it really demonstrates you enjoy the show and want it to continue. And on Patreon, you can support me for a coffee a month or a couple of coffees a month if you're feeling generous. You can support the show at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Right, let's get on with the interview. Today, I'm here with Adam Gaines. Hi, Adam.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. Just a little introduction. Adam is a screenwriter, playwright, and indie author living in Los Angeles. He has written for network TV shows like State of Affairs and The Bridge, as well as writing feature films and his own shorts, which is all very exciting. But Adam, you tell us just a bit more about you and how you got into screenwriting.
I got into screenwriting very early. I watched the movie Scream with my grandma when I was 11, and I told her I wanted to do this, and she said, "Kill people," and I said, "No, write movies." And that was it from that day on. And then like the next year, I got the internet, and I looked up what school to go to, and I was a very weird kid who had the blinders on from a very early age, and I knew by like 12 that I wanted to, write movies and film and TV. Went to one school for it. And then the day after graduation, got on a plane and moved 3,000 miles from my friends and family and started working my way up.
Yeah, which is interesting. Like, is that the truth? Like, people hear about it. Do you have to move to LA if you want to be a successful screenwriter?
I don't know, because I'm not fully successful yet, but I think it does help because it is such a hard business to get into, as you know, and other people you've had on and everything like that, that why my thinking was growing up was, why make it any harder? If you're going to put your eggs in this basket that's so narrow and so focused and so competitive and so challenging, at least pick the basket that has the most opportunities. And while there's production in Vancouver and Toronto and New York and London and New Zealand and Australia, that is, those are crew positions. The majority of the writers' rooms are always still in LA. Even the shows that shoot in New York City, some of those rooms are in New York. But the, like Billions, for example, on Showtime, but or like House of Cards. But most of them are still in LA. You know, The Good Wife, you know, shot in New York for Chicago, but the writer's room was in LA. You know, Empire shoots in Chicago. It's set in New York. Writer's room in LA.
Oh, how interesting. So tell us a bit more about, like you said, you're not entirely successful yet. So tell us a bit more about that journey. Because I looked on IMDb, which if people don't know, is like the place to look for people.
Yes.
And you've got all these things, writer, producer, director, research, whatever. So tell us a bit about your journey and what those different roles entail.
Sure. When I first got out here, I was an assistant like everybody else. And I was an assistant at a major production company that was making film and TV. And so one of the ways I thought to try to get on this track of being a full-fledged writer with representation in the guild who could support himself on just their storytelling ability and wordsmith and whatever, was to go the TV route. I sort of put movies aside for a second because I saw that there was actually kind of a path in TV. And again, we're talking about the challenging nature of this all and how there really are no steps. But I saw on TV there might actually be a small, if not treacherous, staircase that I could maybe climb. And that crucial step where the day job and the dream job kind of intersect is writer's assistant on a TV show. And it has the word assistant in it, but you're not getting coffee. You're actually in the writer's room with 8 to 12 talented professional writers. And you're the only one in there that's not a writer. I mean, you are in your mind on the nights and the weekends, but you're only one there being paid, not as a writer. And you sit there with a laptop and you take notes as they break the story, as they come up with the season, the episode, the scene. And, you know, at the worst, you're a glorified court stenographer there to kind of track and take care and type down everything they're saying. But at the best end of the spectrum, you are there to synthesize the ideas, recap them in a succinct nature, and organize the document at the end of the night so that people who were not in the room that day, like, for example, the showrunner, because he's busy casting a part or in a production meeting, or a writer who's off writing episode 11, so he's not hearing them talk about 12, everyone in the writer's room or the story department can kind of stay on the same page and know what was said that day. Mm. And so I did that on a handful of shows, and it was so valuable because not only am I networking, and every time I'm in a room, I'm meeting 12 new writers that I get to like have lunch with and talk with all day and pick their brain, but also I'm learning all the different types of TV. I did on both a TV show on network TV and on cable TV, different kinds of dramas. Some were more procedural, some were more serialized. And so I saw how to write to an act out and say, okay, well, we got to do 5 scenes. And then the 5th scene right before the commercial has to be the cliffhanger one so that people come back after they watch their Bounty commercial or their Kleenex tissue commercial and want to come and watch more. And I've been on a cable show where writing to the act out and writing to the commercial is not as important. You're there to kind of set the mood and the atmosphere and tell your hour-long story, regardless of kind of where the commercials fall. And then what happens is invariably the room sizes change. People are out sick, people are on set, whatever. And as you prove yourself in these rooms, they call upon you to pitch ideas, write scenes. Hey, I have an outline due Friday. You take acts 3 and 4. I'll take acts 1 and 2. Let's get this done. You're never not in the room, right? So you have the best understanding of the characters, the season, the story. If you're on it for more than a year, you know what happened last season because every year sometimes they hire new writers. I was on a show that went 2 seasons and there was a big turnover in the room between season 1 and season 2. And so I was at an advantage over a lot of the newer writers in season 2 because I had survived and not been fired from season 1. So I was like, hey guys, this is what we did last year. Let's not do that again. And, you know, was given a lot of responsibility in season 2. Even though my title hadn't changed, I brought more experience than some of the newer writers they had hired, right?
Wow, that's so cool. I have so many things I want to ask out of that, but just that's you in the writer's room, and we'll come back to that. But you've also done your own writing and your own producing, is that right? And directing?
Yes, directing I'm starting to dabble in, start a little bit, you know, here with a short feature in the future, but I mean, I like everybody here in Hollywood, I had for many years a day job, and then I had stuff I would do on the side, my own projects. I put out two collections of one act plays, which we'll talk about later at some point, but that in a way gave me a bunch of my own IP, very similar to your publishing efforts as well, that, I made one of those into a short myself. Two of them were optioned, and I actually received a little bit of money because two different people had found them and read them and wanted to direct and make them. And so it allowed me to kind of explore other things besides just traditional film and TV.
Mm. Yeah. Wow. So there's so many. And then before we get back into the detail, what is your dream? Like, where are you heading? What is your plan? What are your goals?
My dream is to have a small production company, and I want to spend half the year in a dark cable drama writer's room, spending 6 months of the year working on a show. If it's not my own show, then supporting somebody else's vision, but hopefully one day it's my own show. And, cable is only a 12 or 13 episodes. So it actually, as a room, you're only rooming for half the year, right? And the other half of the year, I want to make, small movies. I have an independent film career that we'll also hopefully get to talk about at one point, but I like to, write and see films produced and get stuff made. And so there'd be a nice balance, I think, just if we're talking economically of, make your money in that first 6 months of the year working on a show that keeps my health insurance. TV writing can be, I hear, very lucrative. And then the other half of the year, take more risk and adventures while, putting together maybe an under $5 million small movie that might not get a large release or might not do the numbers of, a Get Out or, something like that and maybe make me a ton of money, but could be very creatively satisfying to tell a more personal story, like that. Doing that for 10, 20 years, I'd be very happy.
Fantastic. No, it is so interesting. So, oh goodness. I want to ask about so many things. So this writer's room that everyone's talking about. So one of the things when you're an author, you generally are not so collaborative, as in I have started to do co-writing more these days,
sure.
But mostly a lot of authors work on their own. So how do you balance, because you obviously have written those plays yourself, you do stuff on your own. How do you see the difference between an author working on their own and how you have to behave in a writer's room in order to collaborate with that many people?
Right. Well, you definitely, it's all about putting ego aside. It's about listening. And it's also just to go over further the mechanics of the writer's room, you're actually never actually sitting down and writing as a group. It's more the brainstorming. It's the pitching. It's, does he kill her with the knife or the candlestick? Does he do it in the library or the rooftop? And you're kind of bringing story out first by the season, like where are these characters heading by the end of the season, then by the episode, and then within the episode, the scenes and the beats and all that stuff. Once after, a week or two of doing this, you're then given an outline by me, the writer's assistant, back when I was doing writer's assistant stuff. And then you leave the room and you go off for a week or two, much like an author, and write your episode and write your draft. The story was come up by a committee of people. But you then, at some point when you're assigned, okay, Joanna, your episode 12, that episode 12 kind of becomes your thing. You imprint on it. You try to bestow some of your Joanna, you sprinkle some Joanna into it. Ends of the show that it is, if it's House of Cards, that's a very specific show. You can't just say, I'd like to do a House of Cards episode where they're in space and this one will all take place on Mars. That's not the show. You can sprinkle a little Joanna in it, but you have to stay within the lines of where they're going for the season and what the show is that people are watching. It would be very confusing if, after 20 years of watching Law and Order, my dad turned it on and all of a sudden they were underground and they were running from a volcano. And my dad's like, this is not Law and Order. I know what Law and Order is. It's not that. So you break the story as a committee, then you go off and you write your episode and then you bring it back into the room where it's then rewritten by usually your boss, the showrunner, who either created the show or just is in charge of the, the writing of it. And so it TV can be, it's collaborative and then all of a sudden it's solo and then back to collaborative. There's a lot of moving parts.
Yeah. Okay. I get that. And then you also mentioned something like healthcare. And everyone's like, what, healthcare? Like, that's something that most authors like do themselves in America. You know, you have to get your own healthcare. So, and I was reading about the Writers Guild of America, which has just as we talked, reached an agreement with the major studios.
Yes, and thankfully
avoided strike action. But some of us will remember a few years ago, there was a strike. There was a whole load of things. So what is the Writers Guild of America and why is it so powerful?
The Writers Guild of America is a labor union, and it's designed to protect the writers in many fashions. One, it's designed to protect credits. You know, if you're on a big summer blockbuster, there's a lot of writers. So a lot of times when studios hire, okay, it's a, you know, Batman 9, it's going to be these two writers, and then those writers don't work out, so they hire another two and another two. One of the most powerful things the guild has is arbitration, where they actually review all the scripts and decide and award who actually gets the credit on the movie. And the credit on the movie is very important, right? That credit on your movie is tied to your social security number. Your social security number is how you get residuals. You can't put your kid through college if you don't necessarily get that your name on Batman 9, right? So that's one thing. The other thing it does is it allows for all the studios and networks to agree on a what they call the MBA, minimum basic agreement. What are the minimums that we have to pay every different type of writer for every different type of show, whether it's streaming on Amazon and Hulu, or it's on a cable thing like FX or AMC or HBO or Showtime, or even the networks like Fox and NBC. Now, that's not to say if you're amazing, if you're Greg Berlanti and you're Shonda Rhimes, you're getting paid more than the minimum. There's nothing to be said for supply and demand, but they have to at least figure out as a guild what is the minimums that can be paid at every different level so that there is some kind of universal payment kind of process and that it's enforced, right? And so that you have to, you know, it's enforced and it's regulated and everything is laid out correctly. So those are like two of, I would say, the two biggest functions. And then, as you alluded to, it sort of adds a little bit of stability to such a freelance life, because with the Writers Guild comes the ability to have healthcare if you contribute a certain amount of money every year to the guild, the ability to have a pension and certain sort of safekeepings that you kind of find in other more traditional works of, you know, line of works out there.
Mm. And so the Writers Guild is just for screenwriters, or is it for the authors who own the IP that might become a film, for example?
I believe the guild is for any kind of, I mean, there's news reporters in it. There's, you can, a certain kind of different things. There's a Writers Guild West and a Writers Guild East. I think Writers Guild East covers like soap opera writers and news writers and different things like that. But yeah, in the, you can register, at least here in America, you know, if you have a comic book idea, you can register it with the guild. You can register any kind of IP that you want to kind of protect and enforce. It usually lasts about 5 years. You can say, I have an idea. You pay $20, you send it in, you register it. And so that they keep a file of like, oh, you know, Joanna came up with that alien, you know, movie, whatever like that. But yeah, no, it covers more than just screenwriters, playwrights, authors. There's different things. But yes, it is for strictly entertainment. The, you know, in Broadway, it would be a different thing. Like that, it's strictly for films entertainment for sure.
Yeah, and it's interesting because the Authors Guild has quite a reputation for not being so commercial. so I like that it's commercial. But you mentioned two words there that people might not know what they are, and I don't really get. So credits and residuals. Mm-hmm. Can you explain what those two are in the, you know, and we're talking IP and the money and all that. So credits and residuals, sure. Yeah.
Credits, you know, you'll notice on certain movies, if it's based on a book, it says, you know, adapted by, or it says the book is by so-and-so, the screenplay is by so-and-so. Those are two different credits. The author got money to option that book by the studio, and then a different writer was brought in sometimes. Sometimes it's the same writer, but a different writer was brought in to then adapt that book. In TV, you'll see there's a created by credit, there's a story by, sometimes there's a teleplay by, and story by meaning like one person in the room was got a certain amount of money to just crack the story. Another person in the room got a certain amount of money to go off for that week and write the thing. If it says written by, without breaking that down, it's assumed that the same person crafted the story that then also wrote the script. It's sort of a catch-all for written by. Mm. And also in TV, especially when you credits, when you watch the opening sequence of a TV show and you see all those producer names, in TV, the producer and writer are almost interchangeable on all those shows. So after there's like seven levels to TV writing, after the first two or three, you get a producer type title. So an executive producer on a TV show is usually a head writer or the creator of the show or the showrunner. And in that case, you know, it's very different than film, right? In film, the director is the kind of the top of the ship. Mm. But in TV, the showrunner is the top. And so director will come in for 3 weeks. The first week he'll prep his episode. The second week he'll direct his episode. The third week he'll post and edit his episode. And then he goes off to go do another show across the street somewhere else. Mm. Directing in TV is more journeyman style. And so the credit is a little bit different. And the structure on set is a little bit different. The director is looking to either the writer of the episode or the showrunner to make sure and be like, hey, is this totally in line with what you guys were doing the week before? Because I wasn't here. Like, is everything going the way it's supposed to go? And then credit also impacts, as you were saying, the residuals, right? So when your episode airs, you get a little bit more money. When your episode is sent around the world and in syndication in 100 companies, you receive a little bit more money. If it should be lucky enough to get on DVD or be able to download on iTunes, well, that's an ancillary thing that's in money. So the credit and residuals go hand in hand. If you don't get credit on your episode or not properly credited, there's no way for the residuals to ever come back in an envelope to your little house. Right.
Yeah. And that's what I thought. So if, you know, people listening, everybody wants to get a film deal or a TV deal. And of course, the contract, I mean, there are these horror stories of authors signing contracts. And I won't say any names, but have ended up not getting any money for some blockbuster film that they wrote the original book for. So as an author, like from an author's point of view, if somebody comes to one of us or me and says, hey, we want to turn this into a film and there's a contract involved, what are the things we should watch out for? I mean, should it be trying to get a credit or is it a completely different payment structure for the originator of the IP?
You definitely want the credit. You definitely want anybody seeing the film or TV show to know that it was based on a book. I mean, Dexter, do you remember Dexter on Showtime was based on a book, and there you saw the credit every single time on the show to remind you. And by the way, Jeff Lindsay, I wrote the book. Mm. His book sales went up after that became a hit show. He also rebranded all his covers so that the covers of the book said based on the hit TV show, you know, or, you know, inspiration for the Showtime show Dexter. But what I can say as someone, because I'm also a producer, I'm actually trying to option a book right now myself of somebody's, is you definitely want a contract. You definitely want your lawyers involved. I would say, too, it behooves you on your end to try to get the shortest amount of time on your option with the biggest amount of money. So if someone's going to offer you $5,000 and you think $5,000 is not a lot, then say, okay, well, you only have this option for 6 months, right? You know, options come in like 6 months, a year, and 18 months. Those are the three most common, right? Mm. So you want to, if it's an exclusive option, if you're going to trust a producer to walk around this town trying to sell the rights to your book as a film or TV show, if they're not offering you a lot of money up front, then you want to try to decrease the window that they have it for as short as possible. Because what if they don't do their job? What if they have the book for 6 months and they weren't able to set it up? You want to then be able to go and give the book to another producer, get another $5,000 for them to have 6 months to try to do it. And you can kind of keep playing that until you find the right person who sets it up at the right place. Mm. But what you don't want to do is you don't want to get only $5,000 and then someone has the rights to walk around town for 2 whole years, because $5,000 over 2 years is not as equitable for you as, okay, well, $5,000 for 6 months, I can live with that and hopefully it works and hopefully you set it up and hopefully a lot more comes after that. But if it doesn't, no harm, no foul. And 6 months later, you now have the rights to your book back and you go, you know, and shop it somewhere else.
Mm. And then I guess, you know, one big question would be about the current market. So again, you know, and we know Amazon Studios has kind of an open website where anyone can pitch
submissions. Yeah.
Yeah. But what about Netflix, or, you know, are people now looking more to these bigger, bigger online platforms than the studios? Like, what's the market like right now?
There are a lot of buyers, more buyers than ever. The places you named, like Amazon and Netflix, I mean, those people come from another industry, right? That's tech money. That's a whole different kind of money. They have more money than any of these studios. And because of that, they are outbidding a lot of times the more traditional cable networks, because they can say, oh, that place across the street is offering you $10 million. Okay, well, we'll double it, $20 million. It's no difference to them. They're working from a different amount of money. Whereas the person across the street, a more traditional place, says, well, we only have the $10 million because we only make film and TV here. We don't also sell diapers. We don't also have subscription things. We don't also do all these other things that they're doing. Amazon's money is coming from a lot of different things, right? But because of that, for you as the author or for me as the writer, to entice these places that don't do it as often as like a cable place that's been doing it for 20 or 30 years, they a lot of times want to see a lot more than a script. So you have to come in with a producer or what they call really, and this is in regular TV as well, but come in with a package. You have to say, it's based on this hot book by Joanna. It's got this very famous movie actress who usually only does movies attached to star. It's got this indie director who's just coming off an audience award at Sundance. And you kind of create this package and say like that, because for Amazon and Netflix and Hulu and some of these places, they're looking at the metrics. They're saying, oh, that book and that IP is worth this much. This star's bankability is worth this much. Oh, this director's last movie did this. They can kind of put it together and kind of see what is this worth doing it for that much. Mm. Also, a lot of the streaming places don't do a traditional pilot like network and cable do. They a lot of times are ordering straight to series. So because of that, if they're going to outlay money for 10 or 12 episodes, they want a pretty established hot team to come in and do it. They're not going to necessarily roll the dice and say, oh, you youngster, Adam, you know, with your measly 2 credits and whatever, we're going to give you $45 million to run a TV show for a year and make 12 episodes, right? They're going to give that job to David Fincher or someone who has a, you know, 30-year track record for delivering something like that. Whereas a broadcast or a cable network might take a chance on a younger person because they might just go, or a younger, more inexperienced person, because they might just go, oh, well, it's only $5 million to make this pilot. If we don't like the pilot, we just won't order it to series, right? Mm. But Amazon and Netflix aren't doing much of the pilot process.
Oh, that's interesting. But I guess people listening who are authors of books, they're not going to have people attached and all this. I think that's probably your level, that kind of your producer level. So coming back to my level, so I've got a screenwriter right now who's adapting my London Psychic series, which is kind of, we're saying Luther meets Jessica Jones. So this is, you know,
awesome.
British, but with a female and a bit of a supernatural thing. You know, I have some books. She's a new screenwriter with, you know, she won an award, but no credits. You know, so we're completely unknown. What would be your tips for kind of pitching something like that? If we don't even have an agent. So is that like the first step, or, you know, what would we do in this situation?
First step is definitely the agent representation. In lieu of that, though, what I would do is, you mentioned those two shows, Luther and Jessica Jones, two great shows. I watch both of them. But I would make a list of 12 shows that is similar to what you guys are doing, similar in a good way, not a bad way. Mm. And I would try to reach out directly and contact producers or production companies responsible and tied for those shows. A lot of these production companies look at the people that make Walking Dead. What did they do after they made Walking Dead? They made a spinoff, Fear of the Walking Dead. A lot of people find a genre or a brand and make other stuff in that. So the people behind some of the shows that you are in that mold that you're trying to go for could very well be sitting at home alone with a candle by their desk going, I need my next show, and, you know, and want to build on the momentum or success of their show, their thriller. You know, it sounds like yours is a thriller. And so would be maybe open to be taking a look or attaching themselves as a production company or producer to material that is in the vein of what they either A, like to do, or if they don't like to do it, at least they found a lot of success doing it, so that their name with your name can help propel the brand further. Because they can say, oh, it's kind of Luther meets Jessica Jones, and she's got one of the key people involved from Luther involved. Oh, well, you know, all of a sudden that starts to make business sense, right?
Mm. Yeah, no, it's a good idea. I mean, it's one of those things you kind of think you need people, like being an author, like being anywhere, when you're on the outside completely, you just have to kind of get started, don't you? And a lot of it is about making relationships over time. So let's just talk about your one-act plays, because I actually thought of you earlier this week. I went to see The Mentor. I don't know if you know that one.
No, I don't know.
It's a one-act play, but it had F. Murray Abraham in, who's currently in Homeland.
Oh, I love him. Yeah.
And he was like literally right here by my face. I was in the front row and I was like, hey, that's really weird. He's just like he looks like on Homeland. He's Dara Dahl, if people don't know.
Yeah.
Why write these one-act plays, and how has that gone for you? Like you said, some have been optioned. So talk a bit about what's going on with those.
It was amazing. It started I had been doing them for like 8 years now, but on the side. So what I would do is, in between writing a pilot or a feature, again, not for money, but just as I was practicing writing TV pilots and movies, I would just take a week off or a month off and write a one-act play to kind of just like de-stress. It'd be like, okay, I'm just going to practice and play with dialogue, and I'm not going to worry about what it looks like on the screen or if it'll sell as a movie. Like, these are just for fun. And I had started to get a bunch of them, and I wasn't showing them to anyone. They were literally just for me. I never even printed them out of the printer. They just sat on the computer. I didn't even put them in the closet. As I was coming up in these different writers' rooms as a writer's assistant, I was noticing, especially in cable, that they were starting to hire people that weren't just TV writers, right? I was on a cable show and they had a New York City playwright, a Chicago author, a Canadian poet, all these different walks of life, all these different types of creatives and writers and smart people. And I thought, well, I'm having trouble jumping that level from writer's assistant to staff writer on a TV show. What if I tried to get hot or work in another lane medium to try to bring some attention to the TV work that I want to be doing? So I took my favorites that I'd been doing and I put them together as a free ebook available on download, like on Amazon, iTunes, and all the e-retailers. And I put it out for free in 2013. And it was designed to be a top secret, don't tell anybody, TV sample. It was very short. It was very quick. It was meant to get me back into TV, or back into TV as not a writer's assistant, but as a staff writer. And so it was designed to be read in 1 hour, just a pilot. If you were to show me a pilot of yours, it would take me 1 hour to read it. It's the same amount of time. And it was only 6 one-acts, and each one had a different kind of theme and different kind of genre, or not genre per se, but a little bit different situation. And it was meant to showcase my character and dialogue work in a more untraditional manner than the TV executives were used to seeing. And I put it out for free in the same way like rappers do. That's why I called it mixtape. It was supposed to be like my mixtape, how rappers will put out free music. It used to be in a tape. Now it's just on the internet, on your SoundCloud account, to try to get labels and meetings and try to get representation and stuff. And I did the same thing, and it kind of worked. I got signed to a big agency. I got onto a TV show as a staff writer. And then the reason why I did it again, though, was not for Hollywood. I did it again a second time because we noticed that the downloads, you know, you get a report, as you know, the downloads of where it was going. And going beyond just Hollywood, and that colleges all across the country, some were recommending and saying, hey, I need you to sign this piece of paper so I can use this in my directing class. Or I need the amateur stage rights because we're putting this on in our acting showcase at the end of the semester. My teacher needs you to sign this, whatever. And so I realized that maybe colleges were kind of just getting drunk at night and Googling free theater, or they needed a monologue the next day for class. I don't know why, but they were starting to download it and the numbers were going up. So 2 years later, I decided, I was like, what if I tried to monetize the skill, that dirty word? I was like, but what if I could make a little bit of money from this? I don't know. And so I put out another collection, a sequel of another 6 one-acts. And this time I charged 99 cents on all the same platforms, iTunes, Amazon, whatever. Just the idea that, like, hey, if you liked it for free, would you come back and pay a dollar? And I kind of tried to this time target it more towards colleges. And I actually emailed that out to like 200 drama schools and tried to just say, like, hey, you know, share with the students if you want. They seem to like it the first time. They might need more.
I'm fascinated. How did the people, like, you put it out for free originally and then it did parlay itself into work? How did those people find it? Were they just search? Because I don't think of ebooks as the way to kind of download a play. You know what I mean? Are people searching for plays on Amazon?
I don't know. I have no answer. It was never intended, really. It was intended really just for Hollywood. I was trying to get certain agents, producers, old bosses of mine that I had. Mm. I was trying to get their attention, and then it just kind of accidentally took another course. I really don't know. I don't read plays. I don't use it for that thing. I mean, I read plays all the time, and I had to in college and high school, but I don't sit and look for new plays on Amazon, like you're saying as well. So I don't really know. I've also never been an actor, though. I think a lot of drama classes, monologue, do kind of stuff like that, and maybe people are getting tired of just being able to go to the same classic ones. I have no idea. I think the classic ones are great, but I have no idea. But what it also did, though, and what another reason why I'm so glad I did it, and what we kind of talked about earlier, is this idea of like, now I have IP, right? Mm. In the same way that Hollywood is obsessed with remakes and reboots, and you could literally walk into a meeting if you had this very obscure 1982 lunchbox and said, hey, you see these characters in this lunchbox? Give me $40 million. I want to turn this into a feature film franchise. And honestly, Hollywood is so obsessed right now with that stuff and these franchises that they would be like, well, if it's a lunchbox that did well in 1982, I'm sure there's people that would still be interested. Boom, here you go. Here's your $40 million. So what it did for me was, now I have these 12 stories, these 12 little one acts, because it's two collections of six, these 12 little stories. And as we said, three of them got made into short films. One of them I took and I created my own next TV pilot that I shopped around last year, but did, you know, okay, I got a handful of meetings on. And my latest indie feature, if we start talking about my feature work, my latest indie feature is based on one of my one acts. I expanded one of my one acts into a whole blown movie. And that's the new thing that I'm trying to get financing and casting on now. And so it's been this little treasure trove of stories that I keep mining and not letting go from and kind of working with. And I can also now go into meetings and say, hey, this one has been downloaded this many thousands of times. This one has been done like this. And it's nothing staggering. It's not going to bowl anyone away like a 1982 lunchbox would, but it's helped a little bit say like, oh, you know, his mom is not the only one who likes his stuff. He has other people now, you know, it's able to kind of show that like some of this stuff might be working, or there's potential here if you guys want to take a risk with me.
Wow, so interesting. I reckon we could talk for ages, but we're almost out of time. I do have a question about sort of, you know, as you're saying, your career has developed, and the same time the industry's changing in the same way the publishing industry's changed. Like you said, there's Hollywood at one end with the kind of blockbuster model and the franchise model, and then there's the indie writers, like you're doing indie writing and indie films, and hopefully in being an indie author in fiction and nonfiction will soon be as trendy as being an indie filmmaker.
But let's hope so.
Yeah, let's hope so. Do you see that divergence continuing, the sort of blockbusters at one end, indie at the other, you know, the middle ground falling away, I guess? Or what do you see in the next few years of film and TV?
I hope I'm wrong, and I hope the middle comes back, but all signs point to no. The middle has been falling out now for about 10 years. If you notice, most movies being made are either under $10 million or over $75 million. That the adult movie, the movie that I would usually take my parents to go see, that usually had Bruce Willis in it, or, you know, an action star, something like that. Like, the only person in those movies right now is Ben Affleck. Ben Affleck made The Town, Argo. You know, he's one of the few people that is making studio movies, but that don't necessarily have, well, now, of course, he's doing comic book stuff, but that don't necessarily have a built-in franchise IP, right? There's very few movies like that now. Mm. Even the comedies are getting smaller and going down. Like, you haven't seen too many like Hangover type movies. That was almost, you know, 10 years ago in that like $25 to $30 million range. And it's important, I think, to answer your question, to bring up the numbers, right? You have to bring up the budgets. It's hard for the studios to make the money back on a $40 to $50 million movie if there's no previous brand, if it's not based on anything, if it's just an original, an idea like that you or I would come up with, the indie people. They will take that risk under $10 million for sure, which is more of, you know, under 10 would be more of either your indies or your like Blumhouse horror movies, you know, like The Conjuring and whatever, like a lot of horrors all under $10 million, like that. Or they'll go over $80 million and it'll be a sci-fi epic. It'll be a sequel. It'll be based on a comic book. You know, even Deadpool, which was made a lot of money and was a comic book movie, is on the cheaper end. But even on the cheaper end, it wasn't. It still wasn't in that middle, right? They didn't make it for 40. It was still 75, whatever. So yeah, the middle seems to be going away. Where I think you find the middle now, though, is just not in movies. It's in TV, right? It's cable TV. You know, did you see The Night Of on HBO, like that limited series, or Big Little Lies? Like some of these things that are on HBO now that are, or True Detective, whatever. Those, I think, are the middle ground for adults. They just, they live on TV now. They live on Showtime and HBO and FX and AMC. And I think that's where you kind of have to go for that stuff. If you don't want the art house indie things and you don't want superheroes, I think right now you're watching cable TV then. You know?
Yeah, no, that's right. And then
and Netflix. You know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's what we watch. So just on that then, last question about writing. So we would be as authors pretty much aiming, because I'm assuming everyone listening is unknown and not writing in a massive franchise. We would be aiming for scripts that would come in under 10 million to make. So what are some of the like?
I think that would be very smart.
Yeah. So like if you have like many of my thrillers, I blow up really big places. So that would be a no-no. Like there's no point in me pitching one of my massive explosion based scripts because it would be more than 10 million. Whereas I should be looking at this smaller, which we are, this smaller kind of detective series, which would be cheaper. Is that the kind of mindset to have?
Yeah. I mean, it also depends if you want to make it yourself or not. Last year I was involved in a small micro budget movie. We had less than $1 million and it was a thriller. It was a thriller like you're talking about. And we saved all the money for the guns and stuff for the end of the movie. And for the first 70 minutes of the 90, they're just talking. And, you know, we just did what we could do, right? Like, and we, and, you know, the director said, I have a car, I have a house, I have these two actors, reverse engineer, come up with a story, you know? So it depends. There's two ways to answer it. If you want to go the Kevin Smith Clerks route, remember the movie Clerks from 1994? He wrote in what he knew he had. He worked at a convenience store, so that's why it took place at a convenience store. He was able to write, you know, towards what he had because he knew he was going to make it. So if you and your friends are going to go make an indie movie, I would just suggest writing only what you can kind of come up with. If you're going to go out and write something and try to sell it, I would also still think smaller because, yes, I do think their middle does not exist anymore. So, yeah, you want to kind of limit, like, you know, limit your amount of locations, limit your cast, limit the high conceptness of it. If it's, you know, make it something that is plausible and maybe set, you know, in a smaller area, because the amount of money that they're going to use to kind of bring that to life, you know, they're not going to have what they used to have in the 90s when every single movie was Die Hard on a train, Die Hard on a bus, Die Hard on a plane. You know, by the way, that's no knock at Die Hard. Die Hard is one of the greatest movies ever. But then if you notice after Die Hard in the 90s, there was just Die Hard ripoffs for a whole decade.
I love those movies. Con Air is my favorite movie.
Con Air is great. Con Air is such a great cast. Give me the bunny.
Oh, yeah. Oh, brilliant. So this has all been so interesting. And I'm going to look forward to interviewing you like in a few years time when you're super, super famous director.
And right. I'll be like, hey, I lied about all of this and I made the $50 million movie.
Yeah, exactly. But tell people where they can find you and about your books again and everything that you do online.
So the books are on iTunes, Amazon, and barnesandnoble.com, anywhere that would have an e-reader application. And the first one was called Mixtape, one word. And the second one is called Fire Sale, two words, written by me, Adam Gaines. And I'm on Twitter at nothing_to_gain, G-A-I-N. So nothing to gain, which is my little company that I hope one day will be real. Yeah, that's the best place to find me. My email address is also at the back of both of the books. So if you get to that last page and you want to tell me how much you hate it and or love it, you can just email me directly and contact me there. I'm quite reachable. So, and I love hearing anything, good or bad.
Fantastic. Well, thanks so much for your time, Adam. That was great.
All right. Thank you very much for having me. It was really great talking to you.
So I hope you enjoyed the interview with Adam. I certainly learned a lot. And every time I talk to a screenwriter or someone who does film stuff, I'm like, oh, I really need to get back into that. It'll happen one day. So next week, I'm talking about how to manage your time and automate your author marketing with returning friend of the show, Nick Stevenson. And we talk about specifically how to identify what's really important so you can say no to everything that doesn't fit in order to focus on what you want to achieve. And this is such a big deal for me. And I keep coming back to this. You've probably heard me ask this to multiple people on the podcast because it's something I really struggle with. And I actually have on my desk here, I have a couple of books, but one of the books is Deep Work by Cal Newport. And I actually have specific books on my desk, not to read, because I mostly read on the Kindle, but actually so I'm reminded of the things I'm meant to be doing. So Deep Work by Cal Newport is one of them. And Nick is a master at saying no and focusing on automation. And it's definitely something that I learned from him on and about. So come and join us next week. Happy writing, and I'll see you next time. Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes and show notes available at thecreativepen.com/podcast. You can also get your free author blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at The Creative Pen or find me on Facebook at The Creative Pen. See you next time.